Hello, everybody, and welcome to another wonderful episode of the Bill
Burt
Podcast. Yes, we are back. We are back and better than ever. We have we got a huge guest on here today, an absolute legend.
Absolute. Let me tell you something. I don't like the term GOAT because it implies there's only one, but man, George Lopez is the GOAT. I mean, you look at like my GOATs out there, Bernie Mac, George Lopez. I'll tell you what, Paul Rodriguez, when I was a kid, man, Paul Rodriguez, GOAT. So it is a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Yeah. Thank you very much. You know, when I was at the Comedy Store in the early 80s, I saw Paul Rodriguez one night with my buddy Ernie. And he was wearing a leather jacket. It was hot as fuck. And he had the sleeves rolled up. And he had this eagle on the back, like a sewn eagle. It's real gaudy. You know, I guess, you know, his family's like more from Mexico than mine. And he was so good. Like, really just so funny, man. And I remember leaving, walking with my friend, and I looked at him and I said, by the time I get that good, imagine how good that guy's going to be. And he was never that good as he was that night, because Paul, you know, I wouldn't say brothers, but he was the type of guy that would wing it. His style was to go up and wing it, and winging it is very inconsistent. But when it hits, it's like something you've never seen. And when it doesn't hit, it's like something everybody's seen.
It's like something you don't want to see.
It's like something you don't. And if somebody's seen you for the first time, they'll be like, oh man, I saw the guy last Monday. He was amazing. And you want a level of consistency because, you know, you're at that point, you're trying to get people to.
Gee, I wonder what that's like.
Yeah.
You just described being a comedian. One of the big turning points that I learned in stand-up was when you have one of those nights where you hit a zone. And it just, everything works. You just come out saying hello. Just the greeting is going so well, you don't think your material can follow it. And somehow it happens for you. The best thing to do is to forget all about that show. Because the next night, you're going to walk out there going like, okay, I said this, and then I said that. And then you're going to be in here and not be present. And then it just starts doing this. And then you try harder. Then your mouth gets dry. And everybody goes, must have just been a fluke.
I mean, we saw people go through the Laugh Factory that were kind of hot, that were getting deals in the 90s, and some, you know, carried forward a little bit further, and then some just died in that room, man, and all the people would leave early, or they would not get the deal after, they were there, like that one last two steps before, you know, kind of either getting a holding deal or getting a deal to do your own show. I saw a lot of that happen.
Did you have deals before you worked with Sandra Bullock?
I had a deal with Disney in the early 90s with Sandy Gallen. I think it was Dolly Parton's manager at Disney for like maybe a holding deal for like $40,000. And then I bought a Volvo 850. And then they called me at the last minute because there was something they wanted me to read. And I said, nah, I'm not thinking I'm going in. And they go, well, how's that Volvo that you fucking bought with the money we got you? And I said, I'll be right. I'm on my way over. Yeah. Called me out in the car.
Oh, so you one of those guys got the deal and bought the car. Anytime I got a deal, which wasn't a lot, I would be too afraid to spend the money because I heard all these stories about guys. Remember those stories, Bert? We see your generation kind of like took the beach. So we learned all that. Mm-hmm. Oh, this guy got a deal, man. And he had a Go Pilot. Oh. I mean, I'm not going to say the guy's name, but this guy had a show. It went. And I forget what the fuck happened. 9/11 or a Super Bowl. I don't remember what it was. And this guy already bought the house, the fur coat, the whole fucking thing. And then like 2 months later, they went like three episodes. They canceled it. And then he was selling all that shit. Oh. Lost all his money. Dude, I knew guys in the late 90s got deals and they put it on the stock market into the .com stuff. Oh. Lost it all there.
There was a guy that had a show on CBS and it had just started. It was just on, hadn't grown any roots yet. And he bought a house at the beach with his wife and they went to get the loan. And the guy says, do you have any collateral? and he brought in a copy of TV Guide. He was on the cover of TV Guide that week. And he showed the guy from the bank the cover of TV Guide, and they gave him the loan. And then like 6 months later, he filed for bankruptcy.
Oh my God. Yeah. Jesus. No, there was a lot of those, this guy was on TV, and then like a year later, I went on an audition. He was working the security booth on the lot. I feel like, you know, back then it was real, like now you can save yourself. You have a podcast, you got this going on. But back then, dude, it was like there was no way into the league unless they tapped you with the magic wand. And if that didn't work, when you were out, you were out. You went all the way back down to the pavement.
You know what? It is like a machine. Like if you went to the sewer in like Palisades and you got in and you took this wonderful trip and then you ended up somewhere in the LA River just surrounded by shit, you saw people go through it. And once you went through it, it was almost like you could never recover. You know, I know a lot of guys, I played golf with a guy that had his own show on ABC, got canceled, had a chance to do a reoccurring part on another sitcom on ABC, and his manager told him not to because he says, hey man, you know, you're still hot. You could get another show. That character filmed 100 episodes and he turned it down. And I don't think he's recovered to this day from that decision.
Oh, dude, I knew a couple guys like that. And the big thing is you have to let it. You got to be like a relief pitcher. You know, the guy just takes you all the way out to the park and, like, you got to be like, Clements, yeah, give me another fucking ball. And you have to forget. But, like, dude, I saw guys. This really isn't the angle I was thinking this was going to go, but this is really interesting.
No, it is interesting because, you know, it's people. Some people have seen and they disappeared. Some people that were hilarious and great that nobody will ever know.
Yeah, but the thing, amazing thing about your career is like you on like so many different platforms where now I think it's easy to kind of be like podcast is basically doing a radio show on the internet. But back when you got a radio show, you had to get a radio show. Back when you had a TV show, it's like you had to like there was a small group of people that could actually, it's like the beginning of sports leagues when there was only 18s, there was only so many spots. Now it's sort of like infinite, but you crushed it on the stand-up, then the sitcom, and then radio. And I remember coming out for pilot season, remember that shit?
Yeah.
And I remember hearing you on the radio going, this guy is really great at this too. So I think that's one of like the keys to your success was, no matter how good you are, you're still, as you said, getting, you know, get spit out into the ocean at some point. If you can like get over that, reinvent yourself, pivot, go in another direction.
Right.
How did you handle, because even if you have like a hit sitcom like you did, when that thing ends, the stink on that is like, oh, he already had a show, which is weird because it's like, yeah, I showed that people like me and I can carry a show, but they're like, yeah, we want something new, something different. How do you like navigate stuff like that?
You know, it was a big deal because, you know, no sitcom with like a Latino family, you know, not AKA Pablo went in like three episodes. And there was some other people, Viva Valdez and Sanchez of Bel Air and shows like that. And it kind of really disappeared. And then when Sandra came to see me, Sandra Bullock, and we started to sit down. I remember seeing Tim Allen at the Indianapolis Comedy Club before his Showtime special came out. So he had that act with the power tools and all of Home Improvement was in that hour that he was doing it. He was incredible, man. Like so funny from the beginning to the end. And it was the same every night. Like I was different every night. I started different. I was very, very strong at that pointer, you know, and that dude was just by the numbers. So when you saw him, he was consistent. And when I started to put that idea together for the first show, I was blessed that I had somebody that was a movie star at the height of her popularity who was a little disillusioned with her career and life because she had just lost her mother. So here she was, you know, Miss Congeniality, and she lost her mother, and it just didn't seem as fun and it wasn't real, and she needed to kind of go and mourn her mom, and her dad was still alive and her sister was there. So when she saw me, she saw like a person that was joyful. And she's like, man, George is like so happy with any little thing, that it kind of reignited my opinion of the business, because here's this guy that is just so happy to have an at bat. And I, you know, hadn't turned on anybody, and I was really happy and I was working really hard. And when we got Bruce Helford, who was doing Drew Carey at that time, you know, it kind of, it wasn't automatic, but it was just a good time to be talent, because Disney and ABC, I mean, it was ABC, it was still about the talent and not about the numbers. I saw it become about the numbers after my show got canceled, but it was still about the talent in 2000, 2001.
And meaning that even if it didn't start off with the immediate hit, they were willing to kind of ride with you to see if you could build an audience.
Right. And, you know, I was a mid-season, you know, one of the biggest decisions was that, you know, after 9/11, that was like 2001, and nobody wanted to see comedies, and a lot of shows failed, like you said, shows that maybe were on once or were even in promotions for the upcoming season. Some shows started in October after World Series. So you were in promos for a show that never, it just, nobody wanted to see comedies, and it just, they all evaporated, they all went away. And in 2002, the pilot script was really strong, and we had a meeting at Warner Brothers with ABC on the phone, and they said, well, you know, what do you guys want to do? You want to go mid-season, or do you want to wait till September? And nobody would answer, and they looked at me, and they said, what do you think? And I said, let's go right now. I said, fuck, you know, let's wait. It's better to find out now than to find out in September. And we went and started writing. We put this great group of writers together that Bruce knew, like almost like a dream team of writers. And ABC said, you have to retain 85% of the audience in the four episodes that you're on, April of 2002. And we retained 93% of the audience, and we got picked up. And then we got the front nine. And then as Bruce Helford was telling me that if this show got picked up, I would become the most important person on the show and not him. Somebody knocked on the door and they said, hey, the president of ABC wants to talk to you. And he said, Brooke, me? And they said, no, George. And he goes, you see, it happened already.
You must have been, hey, we got picked up. That's cool.
Yeah, that was kind of it. So, you know, my thing was that whoever was, you know, I like sports and I like boxing and I like competition. And my thing was, whoever was against me, either in the midseason or in September, I would take as a personal threat against my career and my show.
Who was it?
There was Alicia Silverstone had a show. Daniel Stern was a show called Daniel that only went 2 weeks.
I auditioned for that.
It was a good idea. And then toward the end, American Idol was on. And I beat American Idol in San Antonio, which nobody did beat American Idol anywhere. And then one time somebody was reading this article about shows that had to go up against American Idol. And then the guy, I remember reading the last sentence, and he closed it. And he goes, fuck, I wouldn't want to have a show that's up against American Idol. And I said, my show's up against American Idol. And I survived. I survived against American Idol for like 3 years when everybody else disappeared.
I love that you still remember. I can see how like laser you were like, all right, I got to take out American Idol. I wish some of these younger kids could have seen, like, as much as it was way less opportunity, there was something so surreal back in the day when you had like an audition and you went on to one of the lots and you just saw all these TV shows. It was like, I remember walking on to CBS Radford and seeing like a parking space, and it said Seinfeld, and there was a Porsche sitting there, and it's like, oh my God, he's here, and he's working on an episode, like I didn't know where, but I was like, that's happening there. And I remember there was like Sybil Shepherd had a show, and that was back when the show was just called Your Name. It was like Lopez, you know, Sybil, Seinfeld, Cleghorn. They had like all of these things, and like so many of them were comedians. And you were just walking around, and like, it was such a weird time. It was cool. And it was also like, I don't think I want to do this, but this is the way the herd is running. Like, I didn't have any desire necessarily to have my own sitcom, but you just sort of got herded down. Your agent be like, I got you this audition, and you didn't have anything else going on, so you'd go down and try out for him.
when I started writing the show in 2001, like August of 2001, and then we shot it in like the beginning of March 2002. And I would walk onto the lot at Warner Brothers, and I had to park in the midway right there because I didn't have my own show, or I was just kind of working there writing. And the trams would go by and nobody would say anything. And I'd be like, in my head, I'd be like, you know, one day these fucking things are going to stop. They're going to be like, hey, there's George Lopez. And, you know, I just need to zero in on something. And then in 2002, 2003,
feel like the Jordan documentary, you just take everything as a personal.
I needed somebody to inspire. Yeah. And then they would say, hey, there's George Lopez. And I would stop and take pictures with him. I'd bring him inside the set and I'd show him around. And you know, you're right. I think I needed something to zero in on, or else I'm not sure if I would, you know, like Fetch. You see something, you go get it.
Wait, at what point did you get like the parking spot? And there was the sign, like the sign.
Yeah.
Because in the beginning, they sort of give you like the cone.
It's a number,
yeah. Piece of wood and that piece of paper sitting there. Remember that shit? And you just stick it down there. And they're like, oh, man, they don't believe in this show at all.
That's what they do now. When you do it. But yeah, I think after the first season, it had a number, which was my number. And then it had my name and a post. And if anybody would even pull in to like maybe drop something off, they'd get shooed away by the guard. Every stage had a guard standing out front, and you know, you get all that stuff, man. I mean, that stuff is, when you have your own show, it's with their name on it. It's wild, man. The things that you can get.
When did you feel like financially comfortable?
You know, man, you know, I golf, you know, and in 1999, I went up to Pebble Beach to work at the Monterey Cannery Row or the Monterey Peninsula Club, whatever, I can't remember. And a lady got me on Spanish Bay and it was $200. And I was like, $200, Jesus Christ. And then I went to buy some souvenirs at Pebble Beach and I bought two t-shirts and a hat and it was $100. And I remember laughing, walking to my car going, I just spent $100 on two US Open t-shirts and a hat. Yeah. And 3 years later, I had a house there.
Holy shit.
Wow.
I made so much money the first year that my accountant said, have you guys ever thought about owning a second home? And we said, yeah. He goes, well, I think it would be a good idea to put some of this money into like buying a second home.
It's crazy, or else they're going to take it.
Have you played Pebble Beach?
Because that's the thing about money. It's like if you don't put it in play, they're going to put it in play by taking it from you.
Oh,
they just won't let you stop running.
Man, so, I mean, taxes. I mean, just unbelievable. You know, in the mid 90s, I owed $65,000 in taxes. And I remember looking at my accountant and he's like, what's the matter? And I said, I want to fucking shoot you, man, because you've been negligent in your fucking job, and now I owe money for you doing a fucking bad job with my money.
Right.
And he says, are you threatening to kill me? And I said, I'm not going to kill you. I said, I want it. You asked me what I was thinking. I said, I want to fucking kill you. And then,
you just fire him and get a better account?
I did. I fired him, yeah. Okay, but you know, when you started to make a little bit more money, you know, you go as you go. You don't have enough. You go to another guy. And I didn't even really have a lot of money there. He just was lax. And then I remember, you know, writing checks for fucking $2.5 million to Texas.
And were you just working like crazy at that time? Cause you got the sitcom and then you also have road jobs where you can go out. And at that time, if I'm not mistaken, at that time, I don't think there were very many comics selling theaters.
No, then we went to arenas by myself. And then, you know, the first hiatus from like 2002 to 2003 was the first year the show was on. And when we came back in August, I remember what the mother said, I went to Bali. And then the wife said, I went to Tahiti with my fiance. And then they'd gone to Costa Rica. And I toured all summer and came back ready. And all the hiatuses, they traveled and I toured. And then, you know, I was in the Forbes list, like 2005, 6, 7, 8.
Oh, man, dude. I remember all of that shit. God. I remember that, like all the guys that had like the sitcoms. We used to sit there and talk about you guys going, and anytime there's a hiatus, they just go to Vegas and they do fucking valleys and do four shows and they make another episode worth of money. And it was all about like, dude, I remember that week when Tim Allen had the number one movie, the number one sitcom, and the number one book. All in this, he had like the triple crown, and you were just driving through LA, and it was just like Tim Allen billboards. It was like Toy Story, whatever his book was called,
and Manor Pigs, and Home Improvement.
Yep.
You wrote a best-selling book.
Printing money.
Why Are You Crying, Jim?
Yeah.
And I was Why Are You Crying, and we went to the book premiere. It was on the New York Times bestseller list. I hadn't imagined. And then I went to Cartier and I bought myself a watch. And, you know, my wife's like, what are you doing? I said, I'm buying myself a watch. Oh, okay. So every time something good happens, you're going to buy yourself something? I said, yeah. I said, why wouldn't I? And then we went to the Bahamas and I was playing golf by myself. And this guy, dark, man, fucking. One of the darkest people I've ever seen, man. Like, goes by and the tools are flying and the dirt's coming off the side of the road by the golf course. And he looks over and he goes, eh! And all this dust thing, he puts it in reverse. And he comes onto the golf course and he sees me and his eyes are all red, his red tongue. And he looks at me and he goes, why are you crying, man? The name of the special in the book. And I thought, fucking A, man. He backed up. He saw, why are you crying, man? And I was like, Jesus, that's heavy, man.
So when did you, after that, when did you do the radio show? Because I thought that was the late 90s.
Radio was the first one. No, the radio, yeah, it was late 90s.
That's what I thought, because I was out here during that time. And
in 2001, this is how things work out in life, man. Like, you know. I got fired on August like the 12th and 13, 14th, August 15th, I was supposed to go to Warner Brothers to start working on the show and writing the show. So I was already figuring like, how am I going to do it, man? Like work on the radio in the morning and then go work all in the afternoon to do the show. And then after 10 o'clock, I think I went somewhere where I left the studio and came back. And as I came back, they had a cardboard cutout of me in the lobby and somebody was carrying the cardboard cutout under their arm and I saw it go by and I thought that's probably not a good sign that my cardboard cutout has it under their arm and I got fired.
Why did they fire you?
They had a guy, this guy Steve Smith or somebody from Arizona that would flip stations. So if that was like a mega station, he would flip it to like a classic rock, or they would flip classic rock to like a more of an oldies format, and he was known as a guy that flipped stations. So as they fired me through the glass, Warner Brothers is right there off Riverside, was this radio station, and I could see, and I said, that's all right, I'm gonna go right there Monday and start working on my show. I told the guy, that's all right, don't worry about it, man.
Was that guy like one of those clear channel
guys? Roy Laughlin. Dude, the open
remember
shirt,
that Bart?
Crazy hair, yeah.
Dude, with clear all the channel hair, it's like, oh. I had built up all these relationships before, like the internet and all of this stuff. Like you had to build those relationships, and I still like Randy Bauman and in Pittsburgh. Like I still, the guys that survived, but it was just like if you got in and you killed on the hot radio show, like you could. I mean, those guys maybe not the first time, but the second time you came to town. They would build you. Like Randy Bauman in Pittsburgh used to let me come in on like a Tuesday, and I would have no show till like Thursday, and I would just be there doing the remote, like come in Monday night and do the morning show. And he goes, I guarantee you do this time, and then the next time you're gonna sell that room clean. And it was a really hard room to sell. It was one of those improvs. It was like 400 seats. It was in this location that was sort of like, you know, it was up. I remember you drove in. There was only one way in and one way out, and the traffic was horrific. So it was a real tough ticket. But then when those Clear Channel guys started coming in and all of these friends and relationships that I had built, and they just all fucking went away. Right. And I was just like, how the hell am I ever going to promote my shows anymore? And then MySpace came up.
Right. And they didn't even have DJs after a while. It sounded like a guy was in there, but they'd have a guy track stuff on the weekends. And that was like Monday through Friday. The guy would
their goal was they wanted to have one radio station and four DJs. And then they would broadcast that out at different times. And what they didn't understand is like the morning radio shows back in the day when people listened to radio like that was the local guy living there and talking the sports and bitching about the traffic or saying, hey, man, this band came into town last night. I saw him. You got to check him out there. And they got rid of all of that. And it just became it really failed and it ruined a lot of careers.
What about when they would say, don't say Pittsburgh because we're everywhere. So you're like, oh, OK, don't say L.A. because, you know, we go everywhere.
Or you could do it on this break. This break. But on the next break, we're all on the it was weird. It got weird there for a while.
But for a while in that was the best way to sell tickets was the radio. It was beautiful, a beautiful relationship between, you know, radio and disc jockeys and comics and, you know, a strong, like all the old days of like, you know, you could see like with Elvis and going to town and being on there and being good. And then seeing the difference that night or the next time or the next time when you came.
And you could, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you could double dip because you could go in and do the morning zoo and then do the Spanish speaking one. I remember working with a Mexican comic in Miami and they had me go do the white stations and he did the Spanish speaking ones. And dude, all we sold were Spanish speaking tickets. There was not one white person in there. I mean, that thing was fucking flooded. Pitbull was there.
Do that when I toured with Charlie Murphy, rest his soul, and Donnell, when we did the Rich Bitch tour. There was a couple of places we went to. They sent them to the, you know, the Power 106 and the Hot 97 stations, and then they'd send me out to some, you know, oldie thing. And but they would like maybe sometimes would bid Charlie and Don Ellen meet to the white station, but they would never let me go over. It was like the 1960s. Like radio was still segregated. On and be like, you know, so you're on the Chappelle show. Like, what is that? Like the stations I was going to.
You toured with Charlie Murphy, right?
I was the one that had the idea to do the statue for Richard Pryor. And then I, you know, asked the guys and I really didn't know Charlie. You know, he had done my talk show and he had done, you know, really well. And I knew from Chappelle and how, you know, great he was. And, you know, I met him, signed this book for me at the show and he did great. We talked after and I thought, man, that's a good dude right there, man. And when we started to put the Comedy Get Down together, I asked him and then I asked, you know, Cedric and DL. And DL, it's funny, man, because DL was a little bit on his ass. He was doing a lot of clubs. And I remember I called him and he said, let me check my schedule. And I thought, oh, that means no. And then he was in Seattle. And he canceled two shows to get to Peoria. And I remember the girl that worked for him said, you're going to cancel two sold out shows to go to Peoria to do a fundraiser. And he said, there's just something about this that tells me that I gotta go and do this. And he did. And then Cedric was going to be in St. Louis. And he said, let me check my schedule. I said, man, these motherfuckers, man, why don't you just say no? And then I asked Charlie, so I had three dudes and listen, I love Eddie Griffin. I never told this story. And I'm on my way to Dodger Stadium and my phone rings and it's Eddie Griffin. And I look at the dude that I'm going to say, why would Eddie Griffin be calling me? And he answered, he's like, yo, man, hey, I heard you're doing a show for my daddy. And I said, yeah, yeah. You know, I want to be part of that. And I was like, let me check my schedule. And I love him, man. He was you know, that was some interesting Eddie is, I talked to him twice. One time I was doing these interviews and I don't think I learned any, got a better understanding of him after sitting for 2 hours. And then I remember calling Charlie and go, hey motherfucker, you ever get an invitation for just you and you bring somebody and they're like, oh no, the invitation was just for you. He's like, you know, and I go, when I invited you, the invitation was for you. It wasn't plus one. And he said, oh, fuck, I didn't know. I said, no, it's cool, man. I mean, you know, it's cool. I loved, you know what? And he would, I get to the arenas way fucking early, like 5:30. Shows at like 8:30. I get there at 5:30 and I play music and I don't know, man. I just feel more comfortable there than sitting in the fucking hotel room or, you know, I don't really kind of mingle before. So it just seemed like a better play. I jumped rope in there sometimes and I, you know, would fucking walk around or do whatever. And he would get there first and he would always walk in and smoke weed in there and then tell me some stories. And I think there's nobody made me laugh harder. And I don't think I've loved the dude more than that guy.
Yeah, he's a beast. I saw him way back in the day. I saw him first time I saw him was 88, and he was opening for Dice Clay.
Woo!
And nobody knew who he was. And I didn't understand, dude. He was my age. That's what I didn't, because in my head, because I age people by when they started in the business.
Yeah.
So he started like 5 years ahead of me. So I'm thinking he's roughly 5 years older than me. He might even be younger than me. I remember him opening up and we all booed. And that's the funny thing, because people talk about that Philly shit with me. It's like it's kind of karma because we were there like, boo, bring on Dice. And he stood up there, fuck you motherfuckers, I ain't going anywhere. And we're like, all right, I guess he's not leaving.
Awesome.
then he did his act. I remember... yeah, all you guys being at Charlie's funeral and everything. That was what I loved, as sad as it was Charlie was a New York legend, and you guys gave him a legendary send-off. I mean, it was like, it was. I mean, this is so crazy. You get to this age, you start saying, you know, what's the best funeral you went to? So Charlie's, Patrice's, those were like legendary. I remember Patrice's was so funny. When the priest came up at the end, he tried to be funny. Like, we had totally shifted his mindset. I can't say we because I didn't speak at it, but like the guys that went up had totally shifted his mindset. And he was, you know, was probably going to do some heartfelt thing. And I know he died young and blah, blah. He went up there and started to try to tell jokes. But he quickly felt this like going like, oh, man, don't do this. Don't do this.
The same thing happened at Charlie's. It was a perfect amount of funny and sadness, and then I think a woman went back up there and spoke at Charlie's, and it just, oh man, we're like, oh no. And she spoke for like an hour.
And I remember like, Charlie's kids going up there.
Yeah.
It was one of the best jokes for the night.
Yeah.
Saying my dad was in the service. I don't know if how was the joke go? I don't know if he learned how to curse in the Navy, but he definitely swore like a sailor. And we all sit there going, hey, that's pretty good. I probably butchered it, but I was really impressed with that. But
he told me one time he was trying to discipline them and they would laugh at him. And he goes, man, you know how fucked up it is, man. You trying to yell at your kids and they're fucking laughing in your face. And I said, I can't imagine. I go, but look at them. You probably leave the room and they probably say to each other, we just got yelled at by Charlie Murphy. I said, you know, right. So when your name is like a font, of course they're going to laugh at you because they see
name is a font.
You're their dad, but they're seeing what we see. It's funny.
Yeah, I remember Charlie used to come in the limo and I remember me and Donnell kept teasing him. Because he'd always be talking about martial arts. And we were like, oh, you're one of those strip mall tough guys. Like, have you ever had a fight? So he started bringing in. It was like, yeah, okay, you're going to throw this punch down. But we knew he knew what he was doing, but we were just trying to get him going. So one day we were, you know, this old ass limo that could still play like VHS tapes. It came up and it picked him up. He's like, oh, shit. And he went right back into his house and he came out with a fight tape. Him doing fucking karate and like 15 years ago. And there was one clip where he was, they did like a point thing where you'd sort of pull your punch and the judge could somehow tell whose would have connected first. Yeah, yeah. And he kept giving it to this other dude and Charlie got pissed. So they fucking squared off again, and he just straight right drilled the kid. And the kid went down like a tree. And then Charlie did like this really like this formal bow, and got like ejected and shit. And you heard this woman, the woman off on the side of the tape, go, "Oh my god!"
Oh shit! Yeah, he was. I never met anybody like that character. He really was.
Yeah, man, just in such a really. Loyal dude and a good dude. Like we did that tour and he called me just religiously after, and the Chappelle show went away. We kept staying in touch, yeah. And you know, all the way through his wife getting sick and all of that awful stuff, man. So.
All right. Thompson Cigars. I actually love Thompson Cigars. I swear to God. I love Thompson Cigars. Whenever I see Cigar of the Year, I just cut and paste it. Because that comes up my newsfeed, and then I go to Thompson's to see if they offer it. And they have these great sampler packs, which offers those cigars often. Listen, whether you're working from home or just kicking back after being essential, there's no better way. I will be doing it tonight than relaxing with a premium cigar. And Thompson Cigar Company has the deals and selections keep you occupied for hours on end. I have so many cigars right now. I keep buying them that I have them in plastic bags, in counters, and in humidors. Thompson Cigars.
You're ready for a pandemic.
Tell me, with over a century in the business, these guys really know their stuff. They've got the best prices on the biggest brands in the business, from Macanudo to Monte Cristo, and they have the largest selection of samplers online with options to build your own everyday Thompson 5-pack fever program, including over 300 different 5-pack options to mix and match. I have done that so much, it is ridiculous. Looking to try a new top-rated rare blend? But don't want to splurge on an entire box? I've also bought the boxes. Check out Thompson Cigar Tour and a smattering of 5 different. Have you ever bought a box of cigar, Bill, and goes, shit, I don't have room for these. I got to try to smoke them before they dry out.
Oh, yeah. I've done that.
They also have
a problem to have.
They also send out insane cigar deals via email daily, personalized email preference options. So you can sign up to receive them all or just the days you feel like reading emails. Thompson Cigar Company continues to be the number one choice for premium cigars in the USA because they believe they deliver the very best customer experience. I only buy my cigars from Thompson Cigars. I'm telling you, I will have one tonight after I work out with a Coors Light. And it's the greatest way to relax. I love the ones I'm obsessed with right now are the Olivas. Holy shit.
You're like the third person to tell me about those.
Dude, I've have two bags of them.
The Series 5 or something like that? Yeah. Oliva 5?
Oh my God, they're amazing. And nice ring gauge too. So sit back, take a break from all the craziness with the cigar from Thompson Cigars Co. These guys rarely do offers, and I've used their offers. They're pretty great offers. I've used our own promo code to buy cigars with these guys. They rarely do offers, but now Thompson is offering our listeners 15% off orders over $75 or 20% off orders over $99. So take advantage of these incredible savings. Simply go to thompsoncigar.com and use the promo code Bill Burt when you're already to check out. The website is Thompson, Thompson cigar.com and use the promo code Bill Burt.
All right. Lastly, but not leastly, Stitch Fix, everybody. Online shopping can be daunting. You never know if things will fit, returns are difficult, and you don't even know what store to start with. This season, let Stitch Fix do all of the hard work. As the days get longer and the weather gets colder, it may be time to take a look at your winter wardrobe. If you want to make a change this season, Stitch Fix can help you choose new pieces you'll love. If your go-to outfit in 2020 has become sweatshirts or yoga pants, you may be feeling like you're in a little bit of a style rut. Let Stitch Fix help you feel excited about what you're wearing. Did you look over your current cold weather wardrobe options and get a chill? It's time to ditch that old sweater and upgrade that jacket. A Stitch Fix personal stylist can help you pick new pieces that are timeless. So if you don't have any style like me, they got somebody that can help you out. All right, Stitch Fix offers clothing hand-selected by expert stylists for your unique style, size, style, and budget. Every piece is chosen to fit your life and it's the easiest situation. I can't wear this shirt, Bert. It doesn't fit my life. Try on pieces at home before you buy. Keep your favorites and send back the rest. Stitch Fix has free shipping, easy returns and exchanges, and a prepaid return envelope is included. There's no subscription required. Try Stitch Fix once or set it up automatic deliveries. You'll pay just $20 styling fee for each box, which gets credited towards the pieces you keep, and there are no hidden fees ever. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing to fit any occasion for women, men, kids. They ship all over the U.S. and available in the U.K. as well. So get started today at StitchFix.com/BillBurt, and you'll get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's StitchFix.com/BillBurt for 25% off when you're keeping everything in your fix. StitchFix.com/BillBurt. Anyway, one of the reasons you're on here to continue the trajectory of your career here is you have a new podcast on the All Things Comedy Network called Oh My God, Hi.
Yeah. We decided to do that. You know, Al Madrigal and, you know, you guys had a big part of me wanting to do it and him, you know, staying on me consistently to do it. But it's not as awful as I thought it would be, man. And, you know, All Things Comedy, they make it really easy. And it's a good time to do it, you know, because of all this, you know, the pandemic. And, you know, I did a joke last year, the beginning of 20, that got the Secret Service to come and visit me at my house. It's like, what the fuck is this shit, man?
Like, oh, you must have had
a good one. Where are we that they would fucking come to your house?
Wait, man? What was the joke?
There was an alleged bounty on our former leader, and I said, we'll do it for half. And it was considered a threat.
Oh,
and wow. It went fucking goes fast, man. Like I said, hey, I told him, it's an estimate. It's not a fucking threat. It's an estimate. Fucking find somebody to do it cheaper. Fucking get them. And it fucking blew up. Fucking Fox, all right wing, this, that, Steve Bannon, all the conservatives.
That's pictures. Why. Because I was wondering, because they know you're a comedian. So then they had to put on a show. Yeah. They had to go to your house. And
I didn't apologize. I never apologize. I just said, fuck it. Tough shit.
Yeah, just talking to you. You guys didn't like that one? I mean, classic setup, punch.
Classic setup and punch. And, you know, they came down and, you know, I don't want to disparage, you know, but, you know, there's so many threats that, you know, when they leave, you're like, they're almost like DoorDash. Like there's so many of them, you know, that for threats, they said they look at every threat. Well, you can't have, I don't know. I'm one more.
Don't talk yourself into having more visitors here.
Terminal Island. Yeah. I'm cool. But it's been fun. It's been fun to do it. And, you know, Brian Kellen, who's with me, you know, we've known each other for like 20 years. And he was the one dude. I mean, you guys know that. The one guy that, you know, when things go well, very few people reach out. But when shit goes bad, they're like, hey, what happened, man? So he was one of the few people in my life that reached out when things were going good. So when I needed an opening act, I thought, well, who would I want to spend my time with? And that guy literally is probably my best friend. And I've known, you know, I'm from LA. I've got people here my whole life, and it's probably my best friend.
Does he golf?
Yeah. I told him, man, when we first started getting together, I said, listen, man, if you want to see me, you better fucking golf, dude, because you'll never see me for 2 hours a night.
Why I never ran into you.
No, yeah. Never.
Yeah. I don't golf. Look at me. I can't.
I know, man. Shit. You'd blow up out there.
Bill, you've got the complexion the sport was made for.
I can get a membership. I just can't sleeves. Go outside.
They got all sleeves and all that shit now. Fucking Larry David used to wear like a fucking beekeeper's outfit, man. Two gloves and a whole zip thing with that fucking mask that you can't see out of it, the big hat.
Dude, I finally worked with that guy. With the pandemic, I don't know when. I would say a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And he sort of plays like that sort of, you know, what's going on. Dude, that guy is in great shape.
He is in great shape.
When I saw him, I go, dude, you look like a tennis pro, a former tennis pro. It's just like the look. It's his head. His head looks fucking like a founding father, but his body... looks like a former athlete. Like they dress. I think they layer him. That's on the awesome. Show.
Yeah, he's all muscle, man. He's all muscle. Yeah,
how old were you when you started playing golf, George?
I played on Christmas Day of 1981 on a dare. You know, because I'm an only child. My grandparents raised me. Christmases were shit. So, you know, around 11 o'clock, my friend Ernie calls me and goes, what are you doing? I go, man, you're doing nothing, dude. He goes, let's go golf. I go, where? Up here in San Fernando and Silmar. He goes, it's probably closed. I called them, but they're open. We don't even have clubs. They'll rent clubs. So we went and we laughed. They sold us beer. We were 19. They sold us silver bullets, those 32-ounce silver bullets. We drank like four of those. We're drunk, laughing, missing the ball, hitting in the water. And at the end of the day, we hugged and we were like, man, this was awesome. And he stopped playing and I continue to play.
That you have a golf open, correct?
I do. I've had a tournament for the last 14 years. I had a kidney transplant in 2005. And then I was really sick and I was just trying to get better. And I remember telling my doctor, listen, I don't want to be the poster boy for kidney disease. I'm just trying to get better. I want to just go back and live my life healthy. And then when I had the transplant in April of 2005, a day and a half later, when I woke up in the morning, I felt better than I had in my whole life. I was like 40, in my early 40s. And at that moment, 6:45 on April 21st, 2005, I said, it would be a disservice to leave people sick when you have an opportunity to help. And that's when I decided to do the foundation and try to help people because everybody deserves to live a healthy life. I mean, I've drank and I've done a million things to try to fucking get this thing not to work, but it's still working pretty good.
Well, how did that come about where you had to have a kidney transplant?
You know, I didn't really know growing up, you know, I knew I went to bed. That was a symptom of it, you know. And then my grandmother would say, you're not drinking any water after 7 o'clock. And I'd do it again at 5 o'clock. And then she goes, you're not drinking any water during the day, cabrón. And then you're just going like, it's not about, you know, whatever, you know, instead of taking me to the doctor, you can't drink water for fucking April.
What are you saying? You were a bedwetter?
Yeah, because I was born prematurely and the ureters, like let's say that a normal ureter is like this. Mine was like that and it couldn't drain. I know, I almost did that. It couldn't drain right and it backed the urine into the kidneys and toxified the kidneys. But bedwetting is a symptom of somebody being born early.
Oh my! So I thought for half a second because you were a bedwetter, she made you not drink water and you stopped drinking water.
No,
dried out your kidneys. Oh,
no.
Okay.
I didn't know that until you know a few years. It was actually after that a specialist said, "Oh, you were born early," and I said, "Wait,
how did that affect you as a kid? Like, how old were you when that was happening?"
Man, probably like seven, you know, through.
There's the seeds. There's the seeds of the first open mic right there.
Right there. That's what did it. My grandmother would say, fucking, look at your, my grandmother said one time, look at your fucking bathroom, they're like a fucking French toast. And I was like, you know, trying to flip the mattress. And she's like, it looked like a French toast. Fucking awesome, man. God bless her, man. She was my muse. A lot of all my shit came from my grandmother. My whole attitude, everything came from her.
Was she tough love, old school type of thing?
Oh, she no love, just tough. Like she never said, I love you, George.
No love, just no tough. Love,
just tough.
Mom's mom.
I would be standing next to her. What the fuck do you want? Nothing. I'm just came to see. That sends you outside.
Did she get to see your success?
Yeah. Nice. So I created the mom on my show was. This is fucking awesome. The mom on my show was based on my grandmother. And, you know, so here I am, you know, writing jokes like 10 years old, 11, writing on envelopes on the gas company bill. And she would hold it in my face. I cannot have that fucking, now I got to go in person because you fucking wrote out that fucking envelope. Stupid. And then, you know, you grow up and then you become a comedian. And I put her, you know, it's on ABC. I take her to the taping of the first episode, not pilot, first episode. And it runs long, so it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm taking her home, and she's silent the whole way. We're driving on the 5, about to get off San Fernando Mission, and you could see the lights from the, you know, from the freeway, just kind of lighting her, no expression on her face. I said, "So what'd you think, Grandma?" And she goes, "Silent, you want her to know?" That's what she said. "You want to know?" And I said, "Yeah, I want to know." And she just waits, like, you know, and then she goes, "If I would have known it was going to take that long, I would have stayed home." And I said, "Fucking perfect, man." I grow up and I do exactly what I said I was going to do. And no one fucking believed me. And the one person that was the closest to it said, "I wish I would have known it was going to take that long. I would have stayed home." Fucking awesome, man.
That's funny. My parents at this point, they never see anything that I do. They can't, like, the TV has changed so much.
Yeah.
And they just don't give a shit. So if anything's on Netflix, they're not seeing it. It's just like they can't figure it out.
They can't find it.
Yeah, I've been doing this animated show for F is for Family, and they've never seen it. Because people will say, like, is that really like autobiographical, whatever the fucking word is? It's like, I mean, it is, and it's like all of our dads, all of our moms, all of us, you know, the lead That's guy awesome. Is really kind of more me than it is anybody else.
Yeah.
But I was just like, oh, yeah, they've never seen it. Literally, never seen it. My dad called me one time. He goes,
Christ,
Bill, you know, I was asleep on the couch last night. I know you told me not to sleep on the couch. It's bad for my back, but whatever. It's my house. So I'm asleep on the couch, right? And he goes, I woke up at like 3 a.m. He goes, I see this movie and I see Christopher Walken and Al Pacino. I go, I've never seen this movie. So I'm watching it for like 10 minutes. I had like two lines in the movie, right? It just so happened he picked it up. And I go, I'm watching it. I'm like, Jesus Christ, there's Bill. And he wakes up my mom. He goes, Christ, look at this. There's Bill. He's in a movie. So he goes, that was a really good movie. He goes, when did that come out? I was like 8 years ago. I told you to go see it.
Oh, shit.
He's like, well, Christ, you know, I'm so goddamn busy. I got all these projects going, but I was a really. So, I mean, that's like how many options.
Yeah, fucking awesome, man.
Dude, like when we were coming up, if you had two lines
in everybody any movie, saw it.
In any movie, your whole fucking town would go see it. Now,
fucking Taylor Negron, God rest his soul, was the pizza guy in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Oh.
And he was fucking amazing.
He was amazing in everything. Totally he underrated. Easy Money?
Oh, Can I Call You Dad?
Yeah, Can I Call You Dad? Tell her you're the man. Tell her you're bad. I'm bad.
Oh my God, it was so good, man.
Yeah, we watched that a couple years ago before all this bullshit. We rapped on a movie. And the star, Pete Davidson, had us all over his house, and that's the movie we watched.
Yeah.
And we were just like what's so great about that fucking movie is it breaks every rule. Like, you know, like that Sid Field, the first 10 pages, you got to set it in motion and then act one. That movie, you don't even know what it's about for the first 40 minutes. And Rodney's just doing his act and he can't sit still. His fucking legs are shaking as he's talking. Yeah. Absolute beast. And the movie still works. Joe Pesci's in it.
I saw Pesci. I play golf with Pesci and, occasionally, I'll ask him about it. You know, hey, we're browsing. Hey, we're browsing. Huh? Yeah. Take it easy. We're browsing. I loved Rodney, man. Fucking Rodney, and now you do Rodney and nobody. Hey, take it easy. Huh? And they look at you like, who the fuck? Who's that?
I know. Who's my wife voice? Still knows it.
Yeah.
How'd you sleep by saying, oh, I'll tell you, it was a rough one.
I'll tell you.
A rough one. Me and my buddy Verzi loved that one.
You know, I saw Rodney Dangerfield doing a private on a Sunday at Bally's, and I was working over there. I was opening for Sheena Easton, and when I went through the kitchen, the guy goes like this to me. He goes, Rodney. And I go, where? He's doing a private, opens a side door, and he does like 10 jokes in a row. So the audience is already on fire. Boom, 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 boom. 10, you think? He couldn't go any higher. He goes, that's a story of my life. No respect. Fucking boom. I was like, oh my God. One of the most amazing things I've seen.
You know, I just realized.
Seen a performer do.
You know, the tension and release of doing comedy. He would use that. He'd probably be like, okay, this is as high as I can get him. Now I'm going to hit him with the catchphrase. They're going to die laughing. I can bring it back down again and build them again.
That's right.
I never thought of that. Wow.
That's right.
You know my doctor, Dr. Vinny Boombatz.
Yeah. I'll tell you, my wife, you know, the flies pitched in to get the screen door fixed.
You know, there's a classic, somebody told me there was a classic review. Some kid reviewed Rodney Dangerfield and said, like, he just seemed nervous and like his clothes didn't fit, like totally didn't get the act when he's doing the.
Yeah, he did the fucking tie.
He just seemed nervous.
Oh, Carlos Santana is like a huge Rodney fan. And when Jay Leno took over, he asked him to be on the show. And he said, no, you know, I don't really do TV. And they go, so what do you want? You know, what can we do for you? And he said, can you get me every appearance Rodney Dangerfield ever did on The Tonight Show on a tape? And they said, I think we can. And that's what he got him. And then Santana did the show.
Wow.
And I would go to Santana's house a couple of times and he'd go, you want to see Rodney? And I'd say, fuck yeah, let's put it on. And I got him one of those big dolls that you pushed and it was like the microphone. Yeah. Like, you know, one of those things, you know, like that. And it talked. Hey, I tell you, they did like, you know, they did the moves. I got him one of those, took it to him, and then we would watch Rodney.
I saw Rodney in 86, right after Back to School, the third time he made it again, you know? And I saw him with, who's that, Jiffy Jeff's Jim, that guy?
Oh, yeah.
Jeff Nelson. Jeff Nelson opened up, and he came out there and just, like, dude, the people had lawn seats. That's how big this guy was. I saw Eddie Murphy on the Rav tour, like, a few weeks later after that. But I remember he had, like, a plant in the crowd. Rodney did. The guy yells out, he goes, hey, Rodney, what do you do for a living? He goes, I find dates for your sister, okay?
That's right.
Right.
He did that the night I saw him at Bally's like 10 years after that.
I want to know who that guy was.
You know he was using Dennis Blair. He was using the opening act to do it. So it could have been Jeff out there.
Yeah, and you could tell, like, years later I figured out, I was like, oh, fuck, that was a plant. Because just the way the guy did it.
A shill.
He yelled it out. I mean, dude, the guy was in front of like 3,000 people. So this guy made sure he's loud. And I was like, hey, Rodney. What do you do for a living? Yep. They just like butter. I find dates for your sister.
Right?
We were just like, oh my God.
Yeah. Amazing. And I saw him walking to the casino with these two security guards. So these guys are like probably like 5'11", like tall. And this little dude, you know, scrunched over. And we'll go, that's Rodney. And you look and you're like, fuck, that is Rodney. He's kind of, you know, shuffling like this, walking to the casino. And then he walks out with his tie and the red tie and the white shirt, and he's a different guy. I'm sure Coke had a lot to, I'm sure he did some blow in there before he went on.
I never got to see him. Who's one person you never got to see that you wish you could have seen live?
A comedian?
A comedian or musician?
Well, I would like to have seen Elvis. Let's see.
Elvis would be, I would love.
I never saw Richard Pryor live. I would have liked to have seen Richard Pryor.
I never did either. Me either. That kills me.
That would have been, to see him on stage would have been amazing. I remember in the early '80s when Mork and Mindy was on, I remember on a Monday, there's a connected door between the main room and the original room of the Comedy Store. And we hear this fucking explosion. We're like, what the fuck? Open it. And somebody opened the door and Robin Williams was still in his Mork and Mindy costume, like the khakis and the rainbow suspenders. Yeah. And he walked on, he was doing all this stuff and they were going wild, man. I was like, whoa, dude. That's crazy.
I remember one night at the UCB, I was doing Jeff Garland's, had a show there, this improv show, and Robin Williams popped in. And I got to do improv with all of those guys. And in the end, Garland had this thing. I forget, there was some game. It was called the Combo Platter. So you would be sitting down. Someone would start to tell a story, and then someone could interrupt and then take the story somewhere else. So I was sitting next to Robin. And, you know, there was like a good, like, the normal space between chairs. And even then, his arm hair was still touching me. And I remember thinking, like, oh, my God, that is iconic arm hair. He's been making fun of how hairy he is. All of those, what was the comic relief?
Comic relief, sure.
Yeah, he used to always do jokes about how fucking hairy he was. And I was like, it was literally like, you know, he was like a good 6 inches away.
Yeah, really like that.
That arm hair was just,
yeah.
Me, I'm like, oh, shit. I remember him being in high school, hearing him joking about that shit.
Yeah, shit, man. He was another one that was amazing, man.
You dodged all the drug all the drug shit, you kind of just stuck with just booze, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I did all the, you know, I did a little, when I would do a little Adderall, you know, alcohol, not too much blow and all that shit. I mean, one time this guy in Arizona gave me some, and I said, no, I don't really want it. He said, well, go half. I said, and he went half and just took the money. And then he put it in my fucking suitcase. I didn't know till I got back to LA. And he sent me a message. He goes, hey man, half of that shit, your half is in your bag. I said, you motherfucker, the fuck? He goes, ah, they wouldn't see it. It's like a fucking golf ball of fucking coke, man. I still got some, I still have it. Most of it.
I took my daughters and my wife to Bali. And I bring my cigars with me. So, you know, I got my cigars, my cigar case, and I'm sitting out by the pool. We're in the middle of a fucking rainforest and I pop open my cigars and I got a joint in there. I'm like, oh shit. I didn't even know I had a joint in here. I go, babe, I got a joint. And she fucking goes white. I said, what? She goes, that is punishable by death here. I was like, oh fuck.
Oh dude. They need a legitimate exclusive, you know?
Yeah.
Go through you.
Yeah, that's going to happen. I hate to say this. That's going to happen to a comic. That was when I went to Singapore, I was thinking about that. And I was just saying to my wife, are you positive?
Right.
No edible, no fucking.
Nothing.
No oils. Like, because now, like, they got weed. Is like, is there anything in the fucking glass?
Yeah.
Right.
Singapore, if you're a young comic and you're going to Singapore or Bali, this is what you do. Buy a brand new backpack and buy a brand new bag. And just buy
new
everything.
Clothes,
brand
get
new.
A colonic. Just
so
get a
colonic. So you can't have anything in your system, anything. Yeah.
Go up naked. I got nothing. Please don't cane me or kill me. I just came here to tell jokes.
Don't fuck around over there, man.
Hey, have you done stand up in Mexico ever?
No. You know, as much as the Mexicans love to hate in the United States, they hate more in Mexico. So I think I'll stay in my lane over here. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of comedians in Mexico that are successful in Spanish, you know, and I've been a guy that, you know, I added some bilingual to it, but I'm pretty much an American, you know, Mexican.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I know that the big thing is to go down. A lot of guys are doing like Jesus Trejo is trying to translate their act into Spanish.
Well, fortunately, I don't need to.
Yeah. I guess why the fuck would you? Yeah.
Fucking worry about translating this fucking bullshit. It's hard enough to do it in fucking English.
I can just do it in English to make millions. I think I'll do it. I'm looking into German.
George, how do you do your act of spell? I don't give a fuck, motherfucker.
I've been doing this. Yeah, dude, that's that classic. That's one of the things, you know, about getting older that's great is you just start being like that. Like, listen, I do what the fuck I do. I'm happy with what I have. You guys go, you go run that down. I'm not doing
that. You know, I'm divorced. I spend a lot of time alone. I always spend a lot of time alone. I got a house in golf areas. I go and golf. People try to talk to me. I talk to them. Hey, what's up? Oh, yeah, I'll take a picture with you. And then I golf and women are be like, hey, you want to have a drink later on? I'm like, yeah, I'll go down there. Fucking never do. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. Nobody's going to tell me where to be. And nobody's going to fucking tell me what to think. Or I don't even give a fuck what they think for the rest of my life.
Hey, I gotta ask some golf questions because I always make fun. I always make fun of golf.
All right.
By the way, I have three golf bags right here.
Yeah.
I'm a big golfer. I took my dad to Pebble Beach to play right before my last tour. It was a big expense. Expensive as shit.
How many golf bags do you need to buy before you're gonna break 80? That's the funniest thing about that sport.
How many golf bags do you have? How many sets of clubs do you have, George? I'm gonna guess 10.
I probably have more than that. I've given away 10. I probably have 15 at the house.
Yeah. You just get them, Bill. You just get them. You just collect them.
You know, my wife said to me, why are you fucking buying clubs? You're on TV. I just started. And I go, you think they just fucking send people shit because they want it? And yeah, they do.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Those are TaylorMades and those are PXGs.
This is how bad it got. I was a Titleist guy and Callaway came out with some. I still a Titleist guy. And Callaway came out with something. So I called Callaway. I said, hey, man, you guys think you can make me a set of the clubs? And once this came out,
I love that you're whispering like you're cheating
in the insert. And then 20 minutes later, the guy from Titleist calls. We got a call that you were called Callaway about some clubs. I said, why would I do that? Why would I call Callaway for some clubs? Oh no, because are you with us or are you with them? I said, I'm with you guys. What the fuck are you talking about? Did you call Callaway and ask them to make you a set of clubs? I said, I did not call Callaway and ask them to make me a set of clubs. So my friend said that they're making you a set of clubs. That's not you. I said, it's not. Why would I call fucking Callaway to make a set of clubs when I'm with Titleist? I'm with you guys. Putter, bag, ball, irons, everything, woods. Come on.
Come on, Carlito. I'm shitting in a bag, man. That's what should have happened. He should have pulled the wire out of your fucking shirt. All right, I asked for some clubs, man. That's one of my favorite.
Oh, that's awesome, dude. Oh, yeah, that's ever. Awesome.
In a movie.
So wait, what's your golf question, Bill? I want to get you into golf.
Sitting in a bag.
My golf question is, it's the only sport I've seen where they have to keep adjusting the equipment. Like they never had to redesign the football so you could throw it tighter. You could throw the fucking thing. Or you just find another sport. But my thing is, I'm not saying it's not difficult. I know it's extremely difficult, the mental game and all that. Hilarious. But the thing about it is the amount of non-athletes that do play it, that drag the curve down about how hard it is to break 100, how hard it is to break 80. And I just feel like comics that I know that are athletic, if they golf, you know, on a routine basis can do it. So I was wondering, like, why do you keep, what is the thing that makes you keep chasing? Like, how much lighter does the club have to get? How much bigger does the head have to be on the right club before you think you can keep it on the fairway?
Well, the head can't get any bigger because it's maxed out already. But some guys play to get better score-wise. I play for the temperament. Like, I was really an poorly adjusted kid, and golf taught me to be calm, to remain calm, to, you know, stay calm. And all of the flaws that I had in my personality disappeared the more I've played golf. I don't resemble the person I was at 20 or 30 or 40 because I didn't have a father figure that when I cheated, I was cheating on myself. And when I cheated, you know, on people, I was fucking only hurting myself. And as you start to realize that, you know, you can gain peace from this game that's been played for, you know, 1,000 years and not worry about how far you hit it, but worry about how you react when you hit it poorly. Just stay calm.
So can you do the thing? Because I know a bunch of guys that are like, oh, man, the first 8 holes, I was killing it. Then, I went to the trap and the whole thing fell apart. Do you have the ability, the calmness, that if you start off with the classic breakfast ball and you have the first hole goes bad, either you or Bert, do you guys have the ability to be like, all right, shake it
off? I never hit another one. I play the one I hit. And when I play bad or hit it bad, I just go back to the fairway, even if it's just a 100-yard shot. I just try to get it back to the middle to get some.
And when you figured that out, how many strokes did that shave for
me? Fucking probably 8, because if you try to out of the rough, you know, Bert, you're going to hit it back in the rough. So I just get it back in the middle of the fairway and try to get up and down.
By the way, George is a much better golfer than I am. Much better.
At 3 hole-in-ones. Yeah.
I've never had a hole in one. But that's the only reason I play. The only reason I play is for a hole in one. The only reason I play is for an eagle, for a, oh God, I can't believe you carried that water. That one tin cup shot is the whole reason I play. And I don't really like, I love when you hit something really spectacular and like, oh shit, you carried that tree. Oh, that's going to be by the green. I think you might've just drove the green.
Bill, there's a sensation that goes through the club from the ground and the ball through your arms and to your chest that almost, I guess, feels like to have somebody come and hug you from behind, I guess, you know, somebody that you like. And it's what keeps players, like when you hit it on the sweet spot, it's this amazing feeling that you have for just a second. Might be like hitting a fucking crack pipe in the alley, like just, and you're like, oh, you know, and then it's gone.
Oh, there's, well, there's no better feeling. There's no better feeling than on a Sunday afternoon. Let's say you tee off at 10 a.m. It's now 11:37 and you're hitting the back nine and someone says, hey, you guys want to do a Bloody Marys? And you're like, yeah, I'll do a Bloody Mary. And you light a cigar and you just go, shit, everything just peels away. That feeling, oh my God. By the way, I just told you I just like drugs and alcohol. That's it. It's not even the golf.
I got to stop talking to you guys. You guys are going to have me playing.
Shit. Yeah, come on, man.
Nah, man.
I'll call Callaway and I'll get you some clubs.
I got, yeah. I'll be your fall guy. The next time you want some Callaways, I'll say
that.
I'll
get you some. I'll get you some PXGs, man. We'll get you some real shit.
I somebody gave me some clubs, and they just sat there. I, you know. Well, I will say this: when I play, I count every single stroke. I don't want a gimme. I don't want anything. I'm trying to shame the people in the foursome by how much they're fucking cheating.
Oh, so, man.
Like, dude, I'll shoot like a fucking 118 on the front nine. I'm not even joking. I don't give a fuck.
That's awesome.
And I kind of go for the hole too. I like Phil Mickelson. Well, you were saying how you'll try to get back on the thing.
Yeah, yeah. He just goes. He tries to go around shit. Yeah.
Well, it's been a great
thank you, man.
Thing to have thank you too. On here, dude. And yeah. Like I always knew like how successful you were, but to sit there for like an hour and kind of go through your career and to see all the different areas. And back when, you know, it was really limited. I mean, for a white guy, it was limited. It was still difficult. Forget about what you were going up against, man. It's really impressive. But we do have to end this thing because I don't want to start golfing.
Yeah. We'll get you next time. Bert, you and I will play. We'll send him video and we'll get his ass out there.
I will go anywhere to go play around the golf. I would love that.
Just show the Bloody Mary and the cigar. You'll get me there. But
all right, good.
Fuck about anything else.
Cubans, baby. Only Cubans.
Now you get real ones?
Yeah.
You got, yeah, because there's so many. I gave up on those things. There's so many like fake ones out there.
I'll send you some.
All right.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. This is the best guest ever. I got golf club. We got Cuban cigars coming.
Yeah, shit.
We can make this happen.
You got anything to promote coming up? Anything?
No, not really.
I mean, new podcast.
The podcast. Oh my God, hi. Yeah, that's it.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope to see you in a mask-free world.
Yes, man. That'd be great.
Yeah.
It'd be good to see you guys.
All right. Well, continued success. I mean, you obviously have the formula down, man. And thank you so much for taking time to come on
our show.
Absolutely.
Thank you, guys.
Everybody, the legendary George Lopez.
Right on, guys.
Dude, that was fucking awesome, man.
Oh, man, dude. Thank you, guys, man. Right on.
Awesome.